سبيلي غرامك مهجتي وعطفك سبيلي. وعلى ربعك أنا جعل سبيلي لأجلك هجرت أهلي والصحاب. يا عين يا عين
folks, that is the voice, the voice of the main singer there of the late Danny Thomas. Yes, the actor and actor from both movies and TV comedy. I believe he may have even been a vaudevillian performer or done vaudeville type stuff in his younger days. Danny Thomas of Lebanese extraction, famous American film celebrity. And although Danny Thomas performed widely for the Arab American community, that song is over. Although he performed widely for the Arab American community, that record, made in 1952, is his only recording of Arab music. The proceeds from the record, as well as from the numerous haflas, or parties, performances presented by Thomas, Danny Thomas, benefited St. Jude Hospital Foundation, of course, which has become one of the most important institutions in the world for the research and treatment of children's diseases. Known by mainstream America only as a comedian and actor, Thomas continued to sing Arabic songs in cameo and guest performances until just a few months before his death in 1991. Singing a medley of Lebanese folk songs there. And that, of course, is from one of my very favorite Arabic music albums, The Music of Arab Americans, a retrospective collection, 1997, Rounder Records Corporation, Cambridge, Massachusetts. Massachusetts, where, interestingly, you will find one of the two largest Arab American communities and Arabic communities in the United States, the other one, of course, being the vicinity of metropolitan Detroit, Michigan. If you know anything about Arab Americans, know that most of them live in Detroit, the Detroit area, and the Boston area of eastern Massachusetts. Those two places, Michigan and Massachusetts, are American states. Don't confuse them with Arabic countries. Hi, once again. This is Ren Tawil on the Mideast Migraine Show. And that comes to you by way of Free Radio Santa Cruz at 101.3 FM and on our streaming online service, freakradio.org. Click on the red oval and tell all your friends, family, and enemies to remember to click on the red oval for the free streaming service. I was... See, here it is already 13 minutes past 3, and almost, and you may have noticed I rather clumsily and even haltingly introduced the show some 12 minutes ago, as I was in the middle of doing some Microsoft and Dell computer diagnostics that I haven't done in many, many months. Hopefully that'll speed things up here a little more. The Mideast Migraine Show, of course, comes to you every Monday at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, 3 p.m., 1500 hours Pacific Daylight Time. And its companion series, Mideast Migraines, the Saturday edition, every Saturday morning at 11 a.m. Let me give you the phone line. Let's see what kinds of fun we can have with that today. Direct to the studio here. I'll answer the phone and you will go right onto the air. Area code 831-427-3772. Again, area 831-427-3772. A couple more things you want to copy down here. The one-way communication device for this program, Mideast Migraines, on Free Radio Santa Cruz, is the email program for this radio show, MideastMadness@gmx.com. Again, send your email to MideastMadness@gallup.com, MideastMadness@gmx.com. I'd also like you to write down this address to send your donation to Free Radio with, right on the envelope. You don't have to spell the whole thing out, Free Radio Santa Cruz. Just write FRSC, Post Office Box or P.O. Box 7811, Santa Cruz, that's two words, Santa, and then C-R-U-Z, California, zip code 95061. Once again, the address for us to receive your faithful and usually appreciated donations, no cash, check or money order, please. Send it to FRSC, Post Office Box 7811, Santa Cruz, that's short for California, 95061. And again, the phone number is area code 831-427-3772. What a fascinating world this is. Let's do a very short memorial service here to begin with. IJAN, the International Jewish Anti-Zionist Network. Currently active in Canada, Europe, India, in Israel. That's right, the Jewish Anti-Zionist Network has a presence in Israel, Latin America, Morocco, in the Arab world there, the United Kingdom, in the United States. Of course, IJAN, if you've been listening to these shows or are familiar with this through other channels, recently gave a response to this hideous, horrendous piece that somebody spent a lot of money on. I think Elie Wiesel himself probably may have afforded this whole thing. Elie Wiesel is the world's most renowned survivor of the Nazi Holocaust during the Second World War. And very sadly, the man, for all of his anticipated moral standing and high-minded talk, has never, or at least not with any consistency, held Israel to account for the atrocities that it commits against the Palestinian Arabs and the inequities between Jew and non-Jew within Israeli society. Mr. Wiesel, Elie Wiesel, is far more engaged in this whole business of never again, never another Jewish life lost in the terror and the nightmare of the Holocaust, whether or not that happens to anyone else, apparently. The emphasis is always on save the Jews, no more of this kind of thing happening to another Jewish person. Well, within itself, that's all fine and well, except for the exclusionism of it. If the man cannot expand that frame of mind into how this kind of thing happens to other groups, including Arabic groups, people over which the Israelis practice their hegemony, their control over, then what's the point? At any rate, Elie Wiesel puts up his terrible ad in the UK Guardian and in the New York Times. IJAN, International Jewish Anti-Zionist Network, succeeds in putting up its counter to that, and I've already read that at least a couple of times on the show. Basically, it's the IGN ad was twofold: to express outrage over Israel's horrendous, atrocious crimes against humanity, violations of human rights in its primarily and most recently in its attack upon Israel. It's not really a war. It is a slaughter of over 2,000 Palestinians now. There were some 64, 65 Israeli deaths. You know how many of those were not combatants? Three killed apparently by missiles out of the Gaza Strip. The other 61 or so were all Israeli soldiers, or perhaps sailors or airmen, most likely IDF foot soldiers, dying as they've committed themselves to do, if necessary, for what they truly believe is the security of the Israeli state. Turns out to be a rather dubious thing for even a soldier to believe in, even an Israeli soldier to believe in. Well, the other purpose, of course, of the IGN ad is to counter Elie Wiesel's terrible piece of propaganda, which tried to characterize the children who were killed, were murdered by the Israelis in the Gaza Strip over the last 5 weeks or so as nothing more than the victims of Hamas. And Wiesel actually comes out to say this is no different than the ancient Canaanites, the people in the land of milk and honey, which eventually became, in just the last century, the state of Israel. The people who lived there before the Jews, before the ancient Hebrews arrived, the Canaanites. And Wiesel is trying to remind everyone that the Canaanites sacrifice children on the altar of their false and many gods. And Wiesel says this is essentially the same thing that Hamas is doing, when it's not Hamas which is killing them by any means. The ad was essentially three paragraphs containing those statements and charges against Israel and against Mr. Wiesel, followed by a very, very, very long list of Holocaust survivors, some 20-something of them, as I recall, 24, 27, something like that, individuals who are still alive, who survived the Nazi Holocaust, and several hundred more who are descendants and relatives of many who were abused by the Nazis and overwhelmingly killed by the Nazi regime during this time of, well, as Mr. Wiesel would refer to, as night. I am a personal friend of one of those people who happens to live in the Midwest. She is 90 years old now and was just recently arrested as she lives in the neighborhood of Ferguson, Missouri. At age 90, she was arrested for refusing to budge when she sat in honor of police brutality and murder victim Michael Brown. Her name appeared on the list. Also appearing on the list was Dr. Hayo Meir. Well, this past Friday, August 22nd, 3 days ago, Dr. Hayo Meir, proud member of IGN, the International Jewish Anti-Zionist Network, and longtime anti-Zionist activist, he passed away. Hayo was unwavering in his conviction and passion that never again meant never again for anyone. And in his outrage that his experience in Auschwitz is misused by Israel and Zionism to justify the colonization and ethnic cleansing of Palestine. Dr. Meir was born in 1924 in Bielefeld, Germany. When he was barred from attending school there after November 1938, he fled to the Netherlands alone in 1944. After a year in the underground, he was caught and subsequently survived 10 months at Auschwitz. Dr. Mayer dedicated himself to countering the Zionist manipulation of the Nazi genocide to justify the colonization of Palestine. He played a leading role on the Never Again for Anyone tour of Europe in 2010 and of the United States in 2011. We will miss Hayo. Hayo. His message will continue and grow stronger as he is joined by survivors of the Nazi genocide, the descendants of its victims and survivors, and all people committed to justice. Our hearts go out to those who loved him. Some 90 years of age. At the morning of his death, the following letter from survivors of the Nazi genocide and the descendants of survivors and victims in response to Elie Wiesel's attempt to justify the attacks on Gaza by Israel was published in the New York Times. Interesting coincidence. The New York Times counter letter was published, and Dr. Mayer passed away. Hayo, incidentally, was the first to sign on. Since being published, this ad has generated media attention, messages of solidarity, as well as Zionist backlash. Haaretz republished the letter, and the reposting has generated over 30,000 likes on the Haaretz Facebook page. Go to the Haaretz Facebook page. That's HAARETZ on Facebook, Haaretz. Hopefully you, too, will like what you see about that. Please stand with the signers of this letter and against Zionist manipulation of the Nazi genocide. Please sign this letter of support. Obviously, I'm looking at links here on the computer page. Picture here of the ad listed in the New York Times. Looks pretty full page to me. For the full list of signers, click here, etc., etc. Okay. Farewell, Dr. Hayo Mayer. Now, getting back to the stuff of this program, this is the Mideast Migraine Show on Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.3 FM, streaming live at freakradio.org. Click on the red oval. Mazim Kumsie, oh yeah, I'm glad I did that diagnostic work on the computer. Seems to be working a little faster, a little more sprightly. Mazim Kumsie, M-A-Z-I-N in the English alphabet spelling, Kumsie, Q-U-M-S-I-Y-E-H, is a Palestinian blogger. I believe he also teaches at some university or college somewhere. There's even a video. I wonder if I dare to
was 9 when Hitler came to power, but I was about 10 months in Auschwitz. And I learned a lot about the doctrines of a fascist state. The lesson I took from my stay in Auschwitz was anybody belonging to the Jewish people is not allowed to behave ever like our perpetrator, our the people who did the thing to us. Look, I think why I have a certain right to be proud of being of Jewish origin is because the Jews were the pioneers of interhuman ethics. And the Jewish idea of how to treat a foreigner, how to treat a servant, which is in the Old Testament, was taken up by nobody less than Jesus Christ, who was the last of the great Jewish prophets. The prophets in the whole tradition wanted to stress and to to stress the ethical content of Judaism. And so there is reason enough to be proud. And what is happening now in Israel towards the Palestinians is exactly the opposite. It's exactly the opposite. They treat them like vermin. They talk about them in terms, I mean, like, for instance, the chief of staff of the Israeli army recently, the Palestinians are a cancerous growth. I mean, that type of talking is exactly the opposite, and it's actually like Nazi talking. That's what was said about me when I was a boy, a Jewish boy in Germany. And you know, when the Nazis gassed the Jews, the world was silent. Now, the world is silent while the Jews or the Israelis harass, humiliate, and steal away land from the Palestinians. And the world is silent. And I want to awake the world. Because any criticism on the policies of Israel is hampered and made impossible by a terrible trick and crime of Israeli propaganda, that any criticism on the politics of Israel comes out, is induced by anti-Semitic feelings. And our main purpose is to show to the world that we are Jews and we are conscious Jews, and we want to show that you must criticize Israel if you at all want anything good for the Jews in the world, because what Israel is doing is destroying the Jewish world and the Jewish heritage.
Israel is destroying the Jewish world and the Jewish heritage, according to the late Dr. Hayo Maier, who passed away just over the weekend. And as I said, one of the signers of the counter-ad against what Elie Wiesel apparently sees as his duty in life, to perpetuate lies and a kind of modern mythology about a false connection between what happened to the Jews under the German Nazis, under Adolf Hitler, and the idea that this can somehow be made up for by the existence and maintenance of the Jewish state of Israel, including by way of suppressing the native people, stealing their land, ethnically cleansing it of non-Jews. And essentially, as Dr. Mayer put it here, of Israel and its so-called defense forces acting like a new Nazi regime. We lost three good and famous people this week, including Holocaust survivor and humanist Hayo Maier, environmentalist broadcaster David Attenborough, and Palestinian poet Sami Al-Qassim. I'm reading, by the way, from Mazin Kumsier's blog now. I, Mr. Kumsier, first met Hayo, born 1927, died 23 August 2014. That was Saturday. I met him over 10 years ago and communicated with him frequently via email. When he wrote me 7 years ago, and he wrote me 7 years ago when I wrote about the transfer agreement signed between Nazi Germany and the Zionist leaders. I'm going to read that again. Pay close attention. Dr. Hayo Maier wrote me 7 years ago when I, Mazin Kumsier, wrote about the transfer agreement signed between Nazi Germany and the Zionist leaders. Quote, are you aware that besides the Ha'avara agreement, the terrorist and murderer Avraham Stern had written to the Nazis on January 11, 1941, to fight with his Irgun forces together with the Nazis against the British? That is, I think, still stronger stuff, end quote. Here is Hayo as I remember him speaking his mind. Well, that there's a link to YouTube. I don't know if that's the one that we watched, listened to, that we listened to just now. I was listening and watching. David Attenborough, his deep and resonating voice, narrating spectacular nature videos, impacted many of us. These videos will have a special place in our nascent Palestine Museum of Natural History. I especially liked his series, Wonderful World, on BBC. We also lost a great Palestinian poet, Sami Al-Qasim, this week. He was born from a Druze family. Now that's Druze. D as in dog, R-U-Z-E, which is a sect of Islam. Born from a Druze family in 1939, but considered his own date of birth as 1948, because that is when he said he awoke to what was happening to our people, the Palestinian people. He had a great career contributing words to many now famous Palestinian national songs, like this one in Arabic, followed by the English translation. And then there is English writing here. Here is the translation. Standing upright I walk, elevated forehead I walk. In my palm a bunch of olives, and on my shoulder my own coffin as I walk. Here is another poignant poem. The day I'm killed, my killer, rifling through my pockets, will find travel tickets. One to peace, one to the fields and the rain, and one to the conscience of humankind. Dear killer of mine, I beg you, do not waste the tickets. Take them, use them, I beg you to travel. Again, those tickets were three in number. One to peace, one to the fields and the rain, and one to the conscience of humankind. We also lost many other good people, including a mother, Tasnim Issam Judeh, and her four children, in the ongoing Israeli genocidal campaign against Palestinians in Gaza. These simple people, trying to live in the world's largest open-air prison, the Gaza Strip, are equally important to remember, to mourn, and to celebrate their lives. I most grieve for children lost who could have had so much future potential. Yet while we lost good people this week, we also gained much and are enriched by life. As David Attenborough reminds us, life goes on in all its glory and beauty and death and regrowth. For example, Gaza displaced residents in temporary shelters, delivered dozens of babies, and even held weddings. And some friends here and in Gaza are bringing art, music, culture, beauty to this otherwise mad world. Friends whose homes are demolished promise to rebuild, and those injured are healing. Life goes on in all its pluses and minuses. We have so far studied over 40 species of butterflies in Bethlehem University. We adopted a stray dog at the museum and planted seeds, literal and metaphysical. We note that all life is exquisitely beautiful as it blossoms. Without change and growth and interacting with our environment, we have stagnation. We must all be part of this in a positive way, adding to building and wonder and growth. Hence, activism and growth are the epitome of living a meaningful life, exemplified by those who left us. When it is our time to go, will we have lived this meaningful life? Please support advertisements against apartheid, www.adsagainstapartheid, and again, apartheid is spelled APARTHEID.com, adsagainstapartheid.com. Many other interesting titles under Mr. Cormier's email here, regular email, featuring items from his blog. Two days ago, the date of Dr. Hiemeyer's death happens to coincide with the sixth anniversary of the arrival of two boats, the first commercial vessels in 42 years in 41 years, first two commercial vessels in 41 years, having to do the math in my head again, to arrive at the port of Gaza City. I was on one of those two vessels, the SS Free Gaza, the other, smaller but faster, old Greek wooden fishing trawler. They were both former fishing trawlers. The smaller one was called the U.S. Liberty, named after the USS Liberty, which in 1967, the USS Liberty, a United States Navy electronic surveillance ship, quite frankly a spy ship, which was sailing off the coast of Israel, yet still in international waters. Those are busy waters to both commercial and military craft, especially in the war-torn late spring of 1967, when Israel, the Air Force and the Navy of the Jewish State of Israel attacked the USS Liberty, U.S. Navy ship, apparently in an attempt to sink the vessel out of fear, out of the Israeli fear, that they would uncover and possibly scuttle or otherwise sabotage Israel's plans to engage in a sneak attack on the Syrian Golan Heights, which is the extreme southwestern frontier of Syria, which borders Israel. That seems to be why it was so important for Israel to attack and sink a United States Navy ship. They failed in sinking it, even after a roughly hour-long aerial bombardment by fighter jets, bombardment and strafing, machine gunning bullets, causing several hundred holes on the vessel, and then a slight lull in the attack, and for at least another 45 minutes, the attack was continued, this time by Israel's Navy. They sent torpedo boats out, torpedoed the vessel at least once, again failing to sink the ship altogether, but in the process, Israel killed 34 American sailors and wounded 171. Israel, of course, managed to pull off a remarkable political coup by somehow intimidating the United States Boards of Inquiry, the U.S. Navy Board of Inquiry, and other vital departments of the government. Israel managed to co-opt the whole process and literally get away with murder, ending up not being held to account in what was quite obviously a very corrupt and severely compromised, quote-unquote, judicial attempt at arriving to, quote-unquote, justice and accountability. Israel, popularly in the United States, convinced most people that it was an accident. They didn't realize that the ship was an American ship, even though they knew damn well that it was, for a variety of reasons. I went through all the details of this a few weeks ago when I read the entire chapter about the assault on the Liberty in the book I'm reading on Saturdays. Still reading it. Front to back, the book is entitled They Dare to Speak Out, People and Institutions Confront Israel's Lobby. And this entire chapter had to do with what Israel did on that day, June 10th, I believe it was, around June the 10th, 1967, and how they got essentially away scot-free from having to face any formal charges about that. And about Israel and the supporters of Israel in the United States, many attempts, often successful attempts, at oppressing, keeping out of the hands a book which was written by the officer of the deck of the USS Liberty that day. The book was entitled Assault on the Liberty. Okay, now I'm getting away for several minutes talking about that because one of the two vessels that sailed into the port of Gaza City in August of 2008, the smaller vessel, was the USS Liberty. I was aboard the USS Free Gaza. 44 activists, human rights activists, and supporters of justice and peace for the Palestinian people succeeded in sailing into the port of Gaza City. Here is the story as it was passed along to us on the Free Gaza Movement's website, written by Greta Berlin, I believe. Greta is one of the two founders, one of the two or three essential founders of the Free Gaza Movement, entitled, We Have Not Forgotten. And please forgive the duplication of facts as they're delivered here. I probably should have just gotten directly into the article. We have not forgotten. In August 2008, our two ramshackle boats, Free Gaza and Liberty, were hiding out somewhere in the Mediterranean, battling mechanical problems and bad weather as they slowly and furtively made their way to Cyprus. 30 of us impatiently waited for the boats and the 14 passengers and crew already on the boats to come and get us. Finally, on August 21st, 2008, they arrived. The next morning, the sun was shining when Free Gaza and Liberty finally pulled away to sea, and 44 passengers, journalists, and crew had this overwhelming feeling of joy. We were finally sailing to Gaza. Crowds lined the dock and cheered us on as Free Gaza cast off her lines and headed out of port, only to find that Liberty had engine trouble again. We waited for 2 hours as the engineer climbed down into the engine room and fixed the fan belt. Finally, the Cypriot Coast Guard escorted us to the 12-mile limit before sounding their horns and turning back. We were, I'm inserting the fact that those of us who were waiting on Cyprus in the capital city of Nicosia or Lefkosia, the proper pronunciation, were kind of holed up in a dormitory on a campus on the outskirts of Lefkosia. Lefkosia / Nicosia. Hot, dry, already kind of felt like we were in the Middle East. Fairly large island. I believe Cyprus is the fifth largest island in the Mediterranean Sea. It was a long, rather tedious wait for the boats to arrive. Back to the article here. Finally, the Cypriot Coast Guard escorted us to the 12-mile limit before sounding their horns and turning back. We were on our way after working for 2 years to make the voyage happen. Sailing 240 miles across the Mediterranean to the imprisoned people of Gaza. 240 miles. Took just over 24 hours for us to make the one-way trip. The Israeli government had been threatening us for weeks, demanding that we abort the mission, telling us they could not be responsible for our safety, as though we were somehow sailing to Israel and not to Gaza, a territory that Israel had been telling the world was no longer occupied. We had found Israel's Achilles heel. Israel has said It no longer occupied Gaza and had not occupied it since the government pulled out its illegal Jewish settlers in 2005. Therefore, by Israel's own admission, Gaza was free to invite anyone who wanted to come and visit, to sail into its port and be welcomed. We were not asking for Israel's permission. We didn't need to. Gaza was free and we were coming. No foreign vessel had docked in the port of Gaza for 41 years as Israel tightened the screws of its blockade ever tighter, a 20-year blockade, 20-year blockade. Perhaps I'll explain what that's about after I finish reading this. A 20-year blockade, they said, was all about security, but we knew it was about collective punishment and plundering Gaza, stealing its natural gas. We came from 17 countries, from Palestine to Pakistan, from the United States to Europe to Australia, our ages from 81 to 22. We watched Larnaca, the capital of the Greek Cypriot state, twinkle in the distance as a cheer went up from both boats. We are coming. The journalists from Al Jazeera and Ramatan got on their satellite phones and called ahead to Gaza, "We are coming." They were the last phone calls made since Israel then blocked all of our communications the moment the sun went down, leaving us to steam ahead, not realizing that everyone watching our journey thought we had been sunk. And let me throw in the fact that not only, you know, as it says, Israel blocked all of our communications, that includes our ability to use the GPS signal from satellites and helping us to guide our way into the port of Gaza City. Of course, our knowledgeable and experienced seafaring crew and captain knew how to get there anyway. Okay, continuing. Even though it was August, it was cold on the water, and we had not prepared ourselves for the damp. After a few hours being tossed around on rough seas, the water had drenched everything and everyone. We had two options: stay above on the deck and be cold and wet, or go down below to the cabins and inhale the diesel fuel. It was also stinking hot, sweaty hot down there. I remember trying to sleep the first night that I tried sleeping below. I only probably didn't last an hour. It was just too damn hot. Not to mention the discomfort of the sailing. Continuing, the cabins were dry, but the diesel fuel made even the experienced sailors gag. Most passengers chose to stay above, which is to say, sleeping on the deck. Not necessarily with any kind of mattress or pad either. 33 long and seasick hours later, we saw the Gaza City skyline gradually appear in front of us. As we got closer, fishing boats packed with people came out to greet us. We had barely come into sight of the port of Gaza City and its skyline when the boats ran the distance out, the first ones to greet us. I'll never forget that. As we got closer, fishing boats packed with people came out to greet us. The breakwater was packed wall to wall with 40,000 people cheering our arrival. 40,000. You know, admittedly, that might be an exaggeration because I remember my original estimate being, 1,000 or 2,000. And then that, more officially, that figure grew to be about 10,000, and now they're saying 40,000 people. It's possible they included the ones who couldn't get a ringside seat on the best seats on the rocks there on the spit on the breakwater. Continuing, hundreds of boys swam out to our boats from the shore as local fishing boats encircled us. It looked chaotic and dangerous, especially for the fearless young boys in the water. Several dignitaries came aboard our boats via the fishing boats, and we were served tea and coffee while we attached a ladder to the sides of our boats to accept those who have swum out from shore. A Boy Scout band played for us from an adjacent boat. Pretty soon, both boats were jam-packed with people all over the deck and on the roof. The boats themselves, our boats, jam-packed with people all over the deck and on the roof. I remember an almost dread-like sense of, well, I knew we weren't being attacked, but it was hard to make sense out of what was going on. I had a hard time digesting the fact that this was mere celebration of the first commercial boats in 41 years to sail into the port. It was just a crazy, happy madhouse. Trying to make sense of it is, you know, were we supposed to have our passports stamped or something? What was going on? Those were my feelings. Continuing with the reading now. Pretty soon, both boats were jam-packed with people all over the deck and on the roof. The roof meaning a kind of poop deck that both boats had, or what the Liberty had anyway. We hadn't even docked yet, and it was difficult to see how we would sail through all the crowds in the water as the boys grabbed the balloons we had been throwing overboard. All blown up, of course, all in the colors of the Palestinian flag, decorated with the words, Free Palestine. We had worried so much about being sunk at sea, and we're now facing the irony of being sunk by over-enthusiastic boys climbing onto everything they could. We had arrived. After 2 long years and hundreds of thousands of dollars and thousands of volunteers, we had arrived, a day none of us will ever forget. For one brief shining moment, Gaza had an open port. Now in these terrible times for the people of Gaza, many of us wonder if our voyage was worth it. Whether the next 4 voyages, when we landed safely, resulted in any changes. Whether the brutal attack on the Freedom Flotilla in May 2010, when Israeli commandos murdered 10 of our passengers, made a difference. Whether the world would finally listen to a people who simply wanted what all of us want, freedom. Today, on our 6th anniversary, August 23rd, 2 days ago, last Saturday, we remember the promises we made to the Palestinians of Gaza. Number one, we will return. Number two, we will take as many Palestinians out of Gaza as we could. We finally took a total of 28, most of them students who were doing very well. And promise number three, we will let the world know what Israel is doing to an imprisoned population. 2 days ago, we received this email from one of our journalist friends living in Cyprus. Quote, I had lunch on Monday with Sa'ir, the lad you brought out from Gaza on the Free Gaza 6 years ago. He is at university in his second year studying graphic design and animation. He is trying to get a new leg as he has outgrown the old one. End quote. An Israeli mortar had sliced off Zaire's leg at the hip in 2006. And there was little hope he would ever walk again. Mind you, 2006 was 2 years before the first of these 3 latest murderous assaults that Israel has committed on Gaza. The first one is in 2008. They're talking about 2006 here. And there was little hope he would ever walk again. He does today, and he's thriving. On September 8, 2014, Mushir El-Farah, the Palestinian from Gaza who is on the Free Gaza, my vote, an engineer living in the United Kingdom who just wanted to go home to visit his mother's grave, will be on Break the Set, Russia Today, talking about our first trip to Gaza. And for those of you with pen and paper in hand, here's the link, http://rt.com/shows/breaking-set-summary. Breaking set summary slash. That's the link. His words, When he arrived, that momentous day should never be forgotten. These are the words of Mushir Al-Farah, my friend and shipmate. Quote, "It was a great feeling to arrive on that boat, a feeling of freedom that I had never experienced. It was the first time in my life that I had visited home without the humiliation of being questioned or interrogated by the Israelis, without being threatened, having my travel documents thrown in my face, and not knowing whether I would be able to get out or not. It is a sense of liberation I hope every Palestinian will experience one day. A sense of liberation I hope every Palestinian will experience one day. I am proud of being one of the first Palestinians from the occupied territories to enter Palestine without Israeli permission since 1967, end quote. As we mark the 6th anniversary of our arrival, the Freedom Flotilla Coalition is already planning another voyage, hopefully in 2014, this year, the International Year of Solidarity with the Palestinian People. Go to unispal.un.org. That's unispal.un.org. So to all Palestinians in the occupied territories, we say again, we are coming. We have not forgotten you. We will return. We sail until Palestine is free. Let's have a musical break. You may still call me at area 831-427-3772. That's not good. Thank you.
is Monday, August 25th, and you're listening.
اسطوانات نجمة الشرق الأستاذ رزق الله البني. طير عقلي وهد الحيل لعب الخيل لعب الخيل طير عقلي وهد الحيل لعب الخيل لعب الخيل طير عقلي وهد الحيل لعب الخيل لعب الخيل طير عقلي وهد الحيل حلمت النمرة بمنامي السبعة طلعت قدامي حلمت النمرة بمنامي السبعة طلعت قدامي صرت أحسب أرقامي صرت أحسب أرقامي وحسابي رح عب الكيل وحسابي رح عب الكيل لعب الخيل لعب الخيل طير عقلي وهب الخيل لعب الخيل لعب الخيل طير عقلي وهب الخيل بين لي اني ربحان حطيت مية على حصان بين لي اني ربحان حطيت مية على حصان والسابع واحد نعسان والسابع واحد نعسان كان ماشي ومقطوع الحيل كان ماشي ومقطوع الحيل لعب الخيل لعب الخيل طير عقلي وهب الحيل لعب الخيل لعب الخيل طير عقلي وهب الحيل كان معي مال مبحبح ظنت حالي رح اربح كان معي مال مبحبح ظنت حالي رح اربح طلعت من اللعب مشرشح طلعت من اللعب مشرشح وما تغمض جفني بالليل ما تغمض جفني بالليل لعب الخيل لعب الخيل طير عقلي وهب الخيل 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 مرة بتربح شريالين ومرات بتخسر ألفين مرة بتربح شريالين ومرات بتخسر ألفين كل خسارة عالحالين كل خسارة عالحالين حالتنا صفت بالويل وحالتنا صفت بالويل لعب الخيل لعب الخيل طير عقلي وهب الحيل لعب الخيل لعب الخيل طير عقلي وهب الحيل مرة طلعت من البيت واعد مرتي جبلة زيت في مرة طلعت من البيت واعد مرتي جبلة زيت من دربة رحت تخبيت من دربة رحت تخبيت المصاري طاروا عالخيل المصاري طاروا عالخيل لعب الخيل لعب الخيل طير عقلي وهب الحيل لعب الخيل لعب الخيل طير عقلي وهب الحيل قال قالت لدنقنا من البرد من الأمطار وكتر الشرد قالت لدنقنا من البرد من الأمطار وكتر الشرد وإن كنت مخبى يا قرد وإن كنت مخبى يا قرد وزهر كنت زاير الخيل بيزهر كنت زاير الخيل
لعب الخيل لعب الخيل طير عقلي وهد الخيل لعب الخيل لعب الخيل طير عقلي وهد الخيل لعب الخيل لعب الخيل طير عقلي وهد الخيل لعب الخيل لعب الخيل طير عقلي وهد الخيل.
This is the Mideast Migraine Show coming to you via Free Radio Santa Cruz, streaming on our online radio service at www.freakradio.org. Click on the red oval for the streaming link. Also broadcasting to the city of Santa Cruz, California, on the west coast of North America at 101.3 FM. That last piece of music, by the way, from my album, The Music of Arab Americans, a Retrospective Collection, which I picked up at the Electric Fetus on Franklin Avenue, East Franklin Avenue in Minneapolis, some time ago. That last piece of music, Lib al-Khail, or Playing the Horses. Russell Banai, born around 1904, resides at this writing, about 1997, in the same neighborhood in Cambridge, Massachusetts, to which he immigrated as a teen from Damascus, Syria. As a young singer and rik player, R-I-Q-Q, Banai performed first only informally at house parties or sahras in the Boston community of Cambridge. Later, by negotiating concerts, planning programs, establishing dress codes, and endorsing, quote, respectable behavior among musicians and patrons, Banai was instrumental in the evolution of the hafle, the context for musical performance that became institutionalized in the Arab American community, etc., etc. Beautiful album. Same one that has Danny Thomas singing in his only known surviving recording of singing in Arabic. Here's a remarkable piece dated last Friday, August 22, from the New York Times. Not terribly surprising, perhaps, to many people, the fact that it was printed in the Times, at least on their online service. But considering that NYT's recent behavior in how it, like so many other American media institutions, tend to embrace the cause of Israel and its slaughter of the innocents in the Gaza Strip, all the more remarkable. Sunday Review of the New York Times site, opinion section, title, The End of Liberal Zionism. Israel's move to the right challenges diaspora Jews. The term diaspora Jews, of course, referring to the Jews of the world who, in very ancient, going back well over 2,000, about 2,000 years ago, the diaspora, which I believe is actually a Greek word, but is symbolized by a Hebrew character in the Hebrew alphabet, refers to Jews who will recognize their legacy as being of the ancient Hebrew people of Palestine, Canaan, and Israel. Okay, the end of liberal Zionism, Israel's move to the right challenges diaspora Jews. London. Liberal Zionists are at a crossroads. The original tradition of combining Zionism and liberalism, which meant ending the occupation of the West Bank and Gaza, supporting a Palestinian state as well as a Jewish state with a permanent Jewish majority, and standing behind Israel when it was threatened, was well-intentioned. But everything liberal Zionists stand for is now in doubt. The decision of Israel's Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, to launch a military campaign against Hamas in Gaza has cost the lives, to date, of 64 soldiers and 3 civilians on the Israeli side, and nearly 2,000 Palestinians, the majority of whom are civilians. Quote, "Never do liberal Zionists feel more torn than when Israel is at war," wrote Jonathan Friedland, The Guardian's opinion editor and a leading British liberal Zionist, for the New York Review of Books last month. He's not alone. Columnists like Jonathan Chait, Roger Cohen, and Thomas L. Friedman have all rifed in recent weeks on the theme that what Israel is doing can't be reconciled with their humanism. And a color picture here of an Israeli soldier standing on top of a Merkava tank as the tanks gather near the border with the Gaza Strip. Credit Abir Sultan, European press photo agency. But it's not just Gaza and the latest episode of shock and awe militarism. The romantic Zionist ideal to which Jewish liberals, and I was one once, and again, this article was written by, The End of Liberal Zionism, Israel's Move to the Right, Challenge to Diaspora Jews, was written by Anthony Lehrman. Anthony Lehrman, this is from August 22. The romantic Zionist ideal to which Jewish liberals, and I was one once, the author, subscribed for so many decades, has been tarnished by the reality of modern Israel. The attacks on freedom of speech and human rights organizations in Israel, the land-grabbing settler movement, a growing strain of anti-Arab and anti-immigrant racism, extremist politics, and a powerful, intolerant religious right. This mixture has pushed liberal Zionism to the brink. In the United States, trenchant and incisive criticism of Israeli policies by commentators like Peter Beinart, one of liberal Zionism's most articulate and prolific voices, is now common. But the critics go only so far, not least to avoid giving succor to anti-Semites who use the crisis as cover for openly expressing hatred of Jews. In the past, liberal Zionists in the diaspora found natural allies among the left-wing and secular liberal parties in Israel, like Labor, Meretz, and Shinui. But Israel's political left is now comatose. Beaten by Menachem Begin in the 1977 national elections, it briefly revived with Yitzhak Rabin and the hopes engendered by the 1993 Oslo Accords. But having clung to the Oslo process long past its sell-by date, the parliamentary left in Israel has become insignificant. Diaspora Jewish politics has also changed. In the 1960s, when I was an enthusiastic young Zionist in England, planning to settle on a kibbutz in Israel, some organizations had names virtually identical to Israeli political parties. This identification lasted only as long as the institutions that prevailed in Israel seemed to diaspora Jews to reflect a liberal Zionist viewpoint. Today, the dominant diaspora organizations, like the American Israel Public Affairs Committee, the American Jewish Committee, and the Anti-Defamation League, as well as a raft of largely self-appointed community leaders, have swung to the right, making unquestioning solidarity with Israel the touchstone of Jewish identity, even though majority Jewish opinion is by no means hawkish. I want to point out quickly here, the author refers to AIPAC, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, the American Jewish Committee, and the Anti-Defamation League as the dominant diaspora organizations. It should be understood that these three are far more than diaspora organizations, far more, politically speaking, than American Jewish community forms of identity of those communities. AIPAC and the American Jewish community are two very powerful, recognized on Capitol Hill broadly as two of the most powerful and most intimidating political lobby groups in Washington, AIPAC in particular, and the Anti-Defamation League, of course, has a history going way back and also fits that bill. Making unquestioning solidarity with Israel the touchstone of Jewish identity, even though majority Jewish opinion is by no means hawkish. Though squeezed by a more vociferous and entrenched right, liberal Zionists have not given up without a fight. They found ways of pushing back, insisting that their two-state Zionism held out the only hope for an end to the conflict and setting up organizations to promote their outlook. J Street in America and Yashad in Britain, founded in 2008 and 2011 respectively, describe themselves as pro-Israel and pro-peace, and have attracted significant numbers of people who seek a more critical engagement with Israel. I became an Israeli citizen in 1970, and I am still one today. I've worked in the Jewish community in research and philanthropic capacities for 30 years, serving the interests of Jews worldwide. But in the 1980s, I began to rethink my relationship with Israel and Zionism. As recently as 2007, while directing the London-based Institute for Jewish Policy Research, an independent think tank, I still thought that liberal Zionism had a role to play. I believe that by encouraging diaspora Jews to express reservations about Israeli policy in public, liberal Zionism could influence the Israeli government to change its policies towards the Palestinians. I still understood its dream of Israel as a moral and just cause, but I judged it anachronistically. The only Zionism of any consequence today is xenophobic and exclusionary, a Jewish ethno-nationalism inspired by religious messianism, as in Messiah, messianism. It is carrying out an open-ended project of national self-realization to be achieved through colonization and purification of the tribe. Again, now, these are the words of Mr. Anthony Lehrman in an August 22 article in the New York Times web service, The End of Liberal Zionism. This mindset blocks any chance Israel might have to become a full-fledged liberal democratic state and offers the Palestinians no path to national self-determination, no justice for their expulsion in 1948, nor for the occupation and the denial of their rights. I came to see the notion that liberal Zionism might reverse or even just restrain this nationalist juggernaut as fanciful. I came to see the notion that liberal Zionism might reverse or even just restrain this nationalist juggernaut as fanciful. I use my position at the think tank to raise questions about Israel's political path and to initiate a community-wide debate about these issues. Naive? Probably. I was vilified by the right-wing Jewish establishment, labeled a self-hating Jew, and faced public calls for me to be sacked. This just confirmed what I already knew about the myopia of Jewish leadership and the intolerance of many British Zionist activists. a drawing here, a simple animation of a blue cloud, a play on the Israeli flag, quite clearly. Background, blue sky with a few stray clouds, and the Star of David perched atop a wilting branch as if it were a sunflower, with the points of the star slowly breaking off and falling to the ground. Credit Sebastian Thibault. Today, neither the destruction wrecked in Gaza, nor the disgraceful antics of the anti-democratic forces that are setting Israel's political agenda have produced a decisive shift in Jewish diaspora opinion. Beleaguered liberal Zionists still struggle to reconcile their liberalism with their Zionism, but they are increasingly under pressure from Jewish dissenters on the left, like Jewish Voice for Peace, whom I quote many times on this Mideast Migraines program, like Jews for Justice for Palestinians and Independent Jewish Voices. All three of those titles in capital letters. They do represent organizations. JVP, Jewish Voice for Peace, Jews for Justice for Palestinians, and Independent Jewish Voices. Jewish dissenters on the left. Along with many experts, most dissenting groups have long thought that the two-state solution was dead. I'll say it again. Along with many experts, most dissenting groups have long thought that the two-state solution was dead. The collapse of the peace talks being brokered by the American Secretary of State John Kerry came as no surprise. Then, on July 11, Mr. Netanyahu, the Prime Minister of Israel, definitively rejected any possibility of establishing an independent Palestinian state. The Gaza conflict meant, he said, that, and I quote, there cannot be a situation under any agreement in which we relinquish security control of the territory west of the River Jordan, meaning the West Bank, which is to say that portion of historic Palestine, British Mandate Palestine, which is supposed to serve as the main part of a free, independent, and sovereign state of Palestine. Netanyahu said there cannot be a situation under any agreement in which we relinquish security control of the territory west of the Jordan River, the West Bank. Continuing, liberal Zionists must now face the reality that the dissenters have recognized for years a de facto single state already exists. In it, rights for Jews are guaranteed while rights for Palestinians are curtailed. Since liberal Zionists can't countenance anything but two states, this situation leaves them high and dry. Liberal Zionists believe that Jewish criticism of Israeli policies is unacceptable without love of Israel. They embrace Israel as the Jewish state. For it to remain so, they insist it must have a Jewish majority in perpetuity. Yet to achieve this inevitably implies policies of exclusion and discrimination. They are convinced that Israel can be both Jewish and democratic, but they fail to explain how to reconcile God's supreme authority with the sovereign power of the people. Meanwhile, the self-appointed arbiters of what's Jewish in the Jewish state, the extreme religious Zionists and the strictly Orthodox, aided and abetted by Jewish racists in the Knesset like Ayelet Shaked, a Jewish Home Party member who recently called for the mothers of Palestinian, quote, snakes to be killed, are trashing democracy more and more each day. Particularly shocking are the mass arrests, nearly 500 since the beginning of July, of Palestinian Arab citizens of Israel for peacefully protesting, and the sanctions against Arab students at universities for posting pro-Gaza messages on social media. This is the democracy of Israel the man's talking about, my listeners. pushed to the political margins in Israel and increasingly irrelevant in the diaspora, liberal Zionism not only lacks agency, worse, it provides cover for the supremacist Zionism dominant in Israel today. Liberal Zionists become an obstacle to the emergence of a diaspora Jewish movement that could actually be an agent of change. The dissenting left doesn't have all the answers, but it has the principles upon which solutions must be based. Both liberal Zionism and the left accept the established historical record. Jews forced hundreds of thousands of Palestinians from their homes to make way for the establishment of a Jewish state. But the liberals have concluded that it was an acceptable price others had to pay for the state. The left accepts that an egregious injustice was done. The indivisibility of human, civil, and political rights has to take precedence over the dictates of religion and political ideology in order not to deny either Palestinians or Jews the right to national self-determination. The result otherwise will be perpetual conflict. In the repressive one-state reality of today's Israel, which Mr. Netanyahu clearly wishes to make permanent, we need a joint Israeli-Palestinian movement to attain those rights and the full equality they imply. Only such a movement can lay the groundwork for the necessary compromises that will allow the two peoples' national cultures to flourish. This aspiration is incompatible with liberal Zionism, and some liberal Zionists appear close to this conclusion too. As Mr. Friedland put it, liberal Zionists, and I quote, will have to decide which of their political identities matters more, whether they are first a liberal or first a Zionist. They should know that Israel is not Judaism. Jewish history did not culminate in the creation of the State of Israel. Regrettably, there is a dearth of Jewish leaders telling diaspora Jews these truths. A liberal Zionist intelligentsia should embrace this challenge, acknowledge the demise of their brand, and use their formidable explanatory skills to build support for a movement to achieve equal rights and self-determination for all in Israel-Palestine. Author Anthony Lerman, a former director of the Institute for Jewish Policy Research, is the author of The Making and Unmaking of a Zionist. Sounds, according to the details he gave in the article, to be his autobiography, The Making and Unmaking of a Zionist. By the way, a version of this op-ed appears in print on August 24 on page SR4, the New York edition of the New York Times, with the headline, and I somehow lost the headline. Again, the article is entitled The Internet Expression of the Article, The End of Liberal Zionism, Israel's Move to the Right Challenges Diaspora Jews. Anthony Lerman, L-E-R-M-A-N, August 22, last Friday. Now, there are a total of 4 comments made by those who read this online. 3 of them, quite apparently, super pro-Zionist, right end of the political spectrum. D.N. Harris, 14 of Maryland, says, now, pay close attention to this, folks, and then whatever you do, don't stop paying attention when I make my comments on this. D.N. Harris, 14 of Maryland. You cannot be a liberal Zionist without an Israel. Once Israel is secured by whatever means are necessary, then it can become liberal and humanist. If the country ceases to exist, so goes the liberalism and humanism, both of which are good principles, but they cannot exist in a vacuum. If Israel, as Hamas desires, would disappear, so would all of the good things that Israel represents. Israel needs to put aside the liberalism and humanism, albeit temporarily, so they can ensure that the country will permanently exist. Once they have security, liberalism and humanism will follow. Here's my take on that. Promises, promises, promises. This, in other words, is an expression of let's institute martial law, let's suspend habeas corpus, let us, albeit temporarily, put aside traditions of ethical behavior, moral truth. Let us, for the time being, take the emphasis off of human rights and put it upon might makes right. Let's put the emphasis upon the ends justifies the means. Let's do whatever we need to. Indeed, he uses the sentence, once Israel is secured by whatever means are necessary, in order to expand to our liking, geographically expand, the bounds of the Jewish state of Israel, involving all the theft of Palestinian Arab land that it does involve, ethnically cleanse those areas that we, the Israeli Jews, want for ourselves, and guarantee that overwhelming majority of Jews in the population, and then will return to being a truly righteous and moral country. And this is what the Palestinian Arabs have been treated to, by some people's thinking, since 1948. And again in 56, in the Sinai Peninsula. And 67 again in the Sinai Peninsula, the West Bank, Gaza, and Syria's Golan Heights, and East Jerusalem. In other words, folks, just as the state of Israel has never declared its boundaries, did not declare them at any time in 1948 or by the end of the armistice agreements of early 1949, Israel never declared its political borders then, has not declared them since. But as I said, until they declare those boundaries and they're established as viewed on the map state of Israel, they can continue to demand that the Palestinians eat cake. Let them eat cake. As Marie Antoinette is reputed to have said. Actually, I've heard that she never really said that, but I think we've all heard the story and we catch the drift. So this is the huge excuse. We have to make sure that Israel survives before we can have a truly decent, righteous, and liberal society, truly, thoroughly democratic society. This writer, D.N. Harris 14, is leaving out entirely the fact that the reason there has been so much hatred and anger against Israel by the Palestinians and by neighboring Arabs is because they keep expanding, because they maintain a situation which really does deny equal rights within the state of Israel, behind the Green Line itself, denies equal rights between Jew and non-Jew, and of course completely denies political and civil rights and many human rights of Palestinian Arabs in the occupied territory of the West Bank and East Jerusalem, to some degree of the Syrians in the Golan Heights, which Israel also utterly refuses to give up, but rightfully belongs to Syria, and even without the Jewish settlements in the Gaza Strip remains a de facto occupied territory with closed borders, tightly controlled and monitored by the Israeli and Egyptian armies. No airport, no commercial or civil air travel into or out of the Gaza Strip at all. Likewise, for its one seaport, on the shore of the city of Gaza, Gaza City. It is an economic siege which amounts to and I'm having a senior moment again here. I'm not really that old, but this expresses itself more and more. The collective punishment is being exercised against the Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. Punishment for existing. Punishment for the fact that there are those who continue to use armaments in the form of mortars and missiles against Israel out of the Gaza Strip, when that wouldn't be a problem if Israel would make some concrete demonstrations of talking to Hamas about its borders. But Israel keeps using the excuse that they cannot talk to a terrorist organization which still has that awful business about killing all of the Jews in Hamas's charter. I wish that the reference in Hamas's charter would go away. I wish it was never written. But as long as it ever was written, Israel will use this as an excuse not to have open borders with Gaza. And Hamas will not do away with that portion of its charter so long as Israel keeps repressing the Gazan Palestinians. Okay. Second internet response to the New York Times article by Mr. Lehman, was it? At Lerman, Anthony Lerman. Second article, second letter, and this is an NYT pick, from B, capital B, period, in Brooklyn. Oh, well, look, Zionism is not racism, not by a long shot. Most Israelis wouldn't at all mind a Palestinian state if its people could forego murdering Jews. We don't get the news here, how women and children are blown up, knifed, shot, rammed by tractors, their cars pulled off, put off course, and crashed because of rocks thrown through windows. Ways that lone Arab men and boys have of killing. And when we do get the news that a bus has been blown up, instead of photographs of grieving Israelis, we're treated to photographs of the terrorists' mothers. Look at a related article today. Hamas has murdered 18 Palestinians accused of being collaborators with Israel. Collaborators? What does that mean? Does it mean that these men are just sick and tired of Hamas and its single-minded mission to exterminate Jews at the expense of their own families? What do these executions say about an entity that kills dissenting voices? Because if Hamas' goal was a Palestinian state alongside an Israeli one, it would abandon tunnel building and use that concrete for homes and schools, not murder men who can't bear for their homes and schools to be used as munitions depots. All well for Jews to decry the Jewish taking up of arms. Tell again, what's the alternative? Very few of us are so liberal that we'd feel it's okay to be killed. A supporter of Israel, according to whose words is clearly Jewish, him or herself, who is obviously quite proud of their ability to speak so eloquently. B here claims that Zionism is not racism, not by a long shot, hiding, I suppose, behind the enlightened liberal Zionism, which the preceding commenter wants to see put on hold in order to secure an overwhelming Jewish majority in Israel. Most Israelis wouldn't mind at all a Palestinian state if its people could forego murdering Jews. Talking, of course, almost exclusively about, well, you're talking about Palestinians who are under occupation, whether they live inside Israel or in occupied territories, West Bank or Gaza. Remember, the Gaza Strip is a de facto occupied territory. This person bemoans how women and children, referring to Israeli women and children, are blown up in the very rare cases of primarily of buses being blown up by Palestinian terrorists slash freedom fighters. Knife shot, rammed by tractors. Cars put off course and crashed because of rocks thrown through windows. Those last two examples are really pathetic. I mean, the man is talking about being knifed and shot as opposed to blown apart by missiles shot by their own air forces, F-15 fighter jets, or shot from battle cruisers off the coast of Gaza, including three or four children who were clearly killed because they were sighted playing on the beach, not that they had anything to do with hiding munitions or missile firing weapons. Rammed by tractors, yeah, like the tractor was built for the purposes of offensive resistance. They don't have tanks. Tractors is the closest that Palestinian resistance fighters have. It's kind of hard to criticize that. And he has to go to some length, this person, he or she has to go to some length to describe how cars are pulled off course and crashed because of rocks thrown through windows. Oh, how utterly critical one can freely be of those who live under those conditions. Palestinians who live under the conditions of occupation. How pitiful to criticize them for throwing rocks, whether or not they intended the cars to crash. That these are very strained arguments that one can make about how the Israelis are oppressed by those who are oppressed. Hamas has murdered 18 Palestinians accused of being collaborators with Israel. Made it a point to use the word murdered as opposed to executed. Granted, many or most of those executions may have been summary executions, but we are talking about a wartime scenario. 1,900 to 2,000 Palestinians murdered in the course of 4 weeks in the Gaza Strip. And this person is trying to make a case about collaborators killed by Hamas when you don't even necessarily know the conditions under which a Palestinian may or may not have, in fact, been collaborating with Israel. If it's the only way for you and your family to eat, to curry some favor with the invader, it's kind of hard to say no, isn't it? Talk about these men, and then he blames it on Hamas, saying that these men were just sick and tired of Hamas and its single-minded mission to exterminate Jews. Again, this is stated on paper, and again, we refer to this massive disparity between 1,900 to 2,000 Arabs killed in the course of a month with this U.S. taxpayer-paid war machine that Israel uses, 1,900 to 2,000. And during that same time, fewer than 70. Fewer than 70 Israelis are killed, and all but three of them are soldiers killed by Palestinians. And this person uses this as an excuse to criticize an entity, the Hamas entity, that kills dissenting voices. I think there's a massive difference between talking about how Israel needs to suspend liberalism, suspend humanism, while it is on its continuous quest to expand the Zionist state and steal Palestinian land, compared to dissenting voices in an environment like the Gaza Strip, where regardless of who is in charge, whether it be Hamas or Fatah or anybody else, jihad, anyone else, Gaza is on the verge of extinction, at least compared to Israel. De facto. Not talking about a tiny portion of the charter of the Hamas political party. Not talking about words on paper, but what Israel is actually doing to the Arabs. as far as abandoning tunnel building and using that the concrete that it uses in building the tunnels for homes and schools, what difference does it make, for one thing, if Israel is just going to end up bombing those again? They'll find an excuse to bomb buildings. All they have to do is say and turn it into a PR stunt that those buildings were used to house munitions and devices for launching rockets into Israel, when it's like really difficult to verify that, particularly when Israel prevents almost every bit of independent reporting from the outside world, and stuff has to be leaked because of how pissed off Israel's military, Israel's IDF, gets at anyone trying to make a fair and unbiased assessment of what's really going on there. It's pathetic. Comment number 3 on the New York Times article. This is another NYT pick by Pelham in New York. This person says, it is ironic that those on the left, especially so-called liberal Zionists, always warned Israel that continued hostility toward the Arabs would just breed radicalism, yet never chastised the Arabs that continued hostilities towards Israel would also breed radicalism. But this is what happened. Much of the world believes that radicalism is a natural response by Arabs for actions taken against them, but those same people are utterly flummoxed when Jews react the same way. It is either anti-Semitism or the racism of low expectations for Arabs, or both. I'll let you tackle that one in your own mind, because I only have about 5 minutes to get into this last important one. Fourth comment by Julie in New York City. The idea of quote-unquote liberal Zionism has never made sense. The effort that began in the 19th century to make Palestinians a minority in Palestine via migration of Jews from Europe and eventually from North Africa and other parts of the Middle East, the massacres and expulsions of Palestinians in 1948, and the ongoing refusal to allow refugees to return have always been contrary to universal humanitarian values. While Jews in America have embraced liberal Zionism, as long as there has been a Jewish state, it has always been an uneasy fit with the predominantly left-leaning demographic. And despite the efforts of many Zionists, most recently and most notably Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, to portray their cause as universal among all Jews, there have always been clear-eyed dissenters, recognizing the inherent disconnect between an engineered majority of one ethno-religious group over others, including Hannah Arendt and Albert Einstein. There have always been clear-eyed dissenters like Hannah Arendt and Albert Einstein, recognizing the inherent disconnect between engineered majority, a false majority, of one ethno-religious group over others. Julie ends by saying, as an American Jew who has long rejected the contradiction of liberal Zionism and supported the values enshrined in my country's constitution, referring to the United States, freedom of religion, freedom of speech, equal voting rights, and civil liberties, I am heartened to see diaspora Jews abandon liberal Zionism and become supporters of equality and human rights for all. I think that letter alone provides all the sufficient response to the rancid, utterly, ultimately illogical, and sickeningly right-wing bias of the three previous comments. Folks, it is 4:53 in the afternoon. This Monday, August 25. In the year of the gods, 2014. So much more I had ready to read to you. Just cannot do it all in 1 2-hour program or even 2 2-hour programs of Mideast Migraines per week, albeit the Saturday program is reserved almost exclusively to the reading of the books. We're getting towards the end, only 3 or 4 chapters left in They Dare to Speak Out, subtitled People and Institutions Confront Israel's Lobby, Israel's Lobby of Washington, at the United States government. That was written, by the way, by former Illinois U.S. Congressman Paul Findlay, who is Republican, and I believe is still with us. The book goes back almost 30 years. It was published and printed in 1985. I'm reading from the third edition, whose published date is 11 years ago, 2003. That's on the Saturday edition of Mideast Migraines, coming to you at 11 in the morning on Saturday. I, of course, will return to speak at you next Monday at 3 o'clock in the afternoon for that edition of Mideast Migraines. Don't forget, you can communicate with me at the email address for the program, MideastMadness@gmx.com. MideastMadness@gmx.com. Feel free, and I'll probably even respond to you via email, of course. The archive for recorded editions of both the Monday and the Saturday program are available at the website radioforall.net. That's R-A-D-I-O, the numerical character for A-L-L.net, radioforall.net, radioforall.net for the archive of my recorded programs. Thank you so much for listening. I know it can be an exhausting and even disheartening 2 hours, disheartening for more than one reason. But that's the way it is with this kind of subject matter. Talk at you again soon. Thank you and bye-bye.